Well, welcome back, everybody. I thought what we would do is a little review. And then we'll jump into the assignment, just to sort of prime the pump. Let's start off on page 3 with the first of two definitions. About the middle of the page. Jung defined projection as an unconscious, unperceived, and unintentional transfer of subjective psychic elements onto an outer object. That's the easiest part to understand. So something in yourself, you know, recognize, you see it outside yourself. That probably sounds familiar. The next one, second definition is a little harder to get straight. After the quote, the archaic identity of subject and object.
Where is that?
Page 7.
Oh.
After the first quote, after the first indentation. Actually, he calls it a disturbance in the archaic identity of subject and object. What that means is projection is the original state of the human being. And we don't know it's a projection because it seems normal. And it's only when something happens that contradicts our expectation that we begin wondering what's going on. And then we can begin investigating. So all that does is add to the first definition this idea that you've always been projecting. Is that okay? Pages 9 to 19, she goes through the 5 stages of the withdrawal of a projection. First, there's the identity. And then there's a differentiation. Oh, gosh, maybe that person isn't that way, or maybe I'm expecting something of that person which I'm capable of doing, either way. But it usually begins with a disappointment. What leads to the withdrawal of projections is disappointment. Then, moral evaluation, either what I have been experiencing is, it could be bad or it could be harmful, or it is something valuable. So on the negative side, oh gosh, I am a controlling person, where I was accusing the other person of being controlling. Or I am a creative person if I have been admiring somebody for being creative. And then comes the reaction that what I have been experiencing is an illusion. It's not true. Now that's going to be a place where she spends a lot of time as we move through the book. And then, rather than saying, this has just been an error of judgment, we begin to say, what is that thing in me which I have been experiencing on the outside? So that would be the recognition of the psychic existence of what has been projected. And she combines these last two in the same fifth category. And then there's the integration of that content. And what that means is you start doing what you had admired the other person for, or you stop doing what you had blamed the other person for doing. But in the beginning of the book here, she's just laying out kind of what the definition of projection is and how it looks in science and religion. And then the rest of the book is going to be about what does it mean to recognize the psychic existence of what had been projected. The problem is that you often can't and shouldn't withdraw the projection into the ego. To withdraw a projection in the ego would mean, okay, I admire so-and-so for being creative. I'm creative. I'll write a book. But when you try to do that, you find the book doesn't come. Because these contents aren't meant to be taken into the ego, they're to be recognized as part of the unconscious. That you don't control by choice, but that you have to learn to serve. So that's going to be a large part of the last sections of the book. Don't worry if that makes sense now. It will as we go along. In other words, not all projections can be brought back into the ego. In our jargon, some are brought back into the self. Meaning they're factors you have to learn to serve, not factors you can control.
You're saying most of them are that way?
No. No, I don't think most of them are. I'd say 50-50, maybe. Certainly, I think the further you go in the inner journey, the more they're likely not to be ego contents. Because what the withdrawal into the ego means is your ego is developing. You're getting more responsible, you're getting stronger, getting more reliable, less defensive, more of a solid human being. And then once that is established, although it's not like it's established and it's over with, because these things sort of go back and forth. But by and large, I think you get stronger. And then the question is not how do I strengthen myself, but what do I stand for? What do I believe in? What do I serve? What do I contribute? And all of those questions are answered for Jung when you begin to recognize there are parts of yourself asking something of you.
So all the projection comes from
yourself. That's true, but to be a little more practical, I think you could say some projections come from the shadow, some from the anima, and some from the self. Yes, the shadow and the anima are originally part of the self. But as we get more aware of ourselves, they crystallize out into being separate factors. And so you could say that the shadow contents are integrated into the ego. The anima and the self are integrated back into the unconscious and become voices in yourself that you have to establish a relationship to. You just can't control them. They have their own say as well. Or the shadow, you have the say. But with these contents, there's a reciprocity that's required. So they were the two definitions and the five stages. That's basic. We're going to keep building on that. So if you're fuzzy, holler.
Hi there. I did have a question about, I know you said at one point, or we talked about the stage about what I experienced in stage of illusion, and why is it important to go through that stage? So you can detach from it?
So you can detach from it, yeah. Again, I think we can divide this up into positive and negative projections. Positive meaning, I admire you. Negative meaning, I dislike or I fear you. And in a positive projection, let's say I admire an artist. And I keep getting into trouble in relationship with artists. And I realize, oh, I keep getting into trouble with relationship with artists. I better stop hanging out with these sorts of people. I better resist that attraction. Some people will stop right there. And they've broken the pattern. They'll go have a relationship with a who knows what, you know, somebody who's not creative. So even that is a step forward. But it doesn't really address what was it in me that I was projecting. And that is, I could be a writer too, or I could be an artist too.
Can fear and admiration coexist?
I think so, yeah.
So like, growing up, you're supposed to fear God,
yeah.
But then you also admire these supposed qualities.
Right, yeah, yeah. I think that would be awe.
Awe.
Yeah. Yeah, and so we're going to get into what are religious projections. That's not too hard to see, but then we'll get into what are scientific projections. And that's a little bit harder to see.
It seems like if we think about modern brain research, that we could look at projection originally as sort of a cultural evolution because it allowed relationship.
Yes.
You know, there's part brain science where they call this thing they've discovered blind sight. And if you've had damage to the visual cortex and you can't see out of one eye, but you can see out of the other eye, if they put you in a screen so that your vision is split and you're looking with the blind eye and they show you pictures of people's faces through this eye and then the eye you can see through are other images, and they show you a series of people's faces and emotions, your face will automatically register the emotion that you see through that blind eye. So they theorize that the brain has other ways of gathering visual information.
Wow.
And they call that blind sight.
I was reading, they were saying people would even start reaching for things that they don't think they can see. That they can't see, but they can somehow reach for them and grab them.
Yeah.
So it's like, yeah, it's that same.
So it's as though...
That's yeah. Powerful.
Yeah. It's as though the... What is behind projection initially allowed us to evolve culturally. And now that Jung has psychologically understood the ramifications of projection,
yeah.
Now we can make another cultural evolution through looking at it psychologically.
Absolutely.
So I think that's pretty fascinating.
That's very fascinating.
That it's on one, in our earlier evolution, it served one function, it brought us together. Now it's begun to push us apart, and Jung comes along and sees how to revolutionize.
Yeah.
That.
Well said. And Jung, for the Freudians, the projection is a defense mechanism. For Jung, it's the way we become conscious.
And that goes along with brain science, modern brain science. If you look at it that way.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Carol.
I guess I have a bit of confusion between the moral evaluation at the third stage and the moral evaluation at the fifth or sixth stage.
The fifth or sixth stage is, what am I going to do about it? The third stage is, I have to separate myself from this. I was reading a case study by a Freudian, and in the study, I think it was a woman, working with a woman, was working with somebody who had a tendency to idealize. And every time the client or patient would idealize the therapist would say, "Now you're idealizing me. Stop it." That was the end of the therapy, to break down these idealizations. That would be the third stage, how it is getting in your way. But what bothers me about that approach is they never say, what is that greatness in you that you have been seeing in me? For them, that third evaluation is the end of the story. Of course, we would say that that greatness is the self. And you project the self. No, that's not good. But if you can find the self in you, then you find your inner taskmaster. Now, she slips in something which I got by me. But we're going to see it come back at least two or three more times. And that's on page 13. She's saying what I sort of alluded to a minute ago. A look at the end of the second paragraph. If one wants to prevent such a renewal of the projection, see where I am there? The content must be recognized as psychically real, though not as part of the subject, but rather as an autonomous power. That's kind of what I was saying about you don't integrate it into the ego, you integrate it back into the unconscious. Now, a large part of the book, after we get through with the science chapter, is going to be, so what exactly is the nature of that autonomous power? So really, projection recollection turns to a discussion of what's the nature of the unconscious. First of all, we'll be seeing the nature of the unconscious is to exteriorize itself. And secondly, we're left with the almost philosophical, but also psychological issues of, so then what is the nature of the unconscious once it's been integrated? Back into itself, you might say. Keep that in mind, because we'll be returning to that idea a couple of times. And she ends... I think she begins the science chapter with a paragraph which I think if you understood this will make what she's saying a little easier.
Kiria, I wonder how this relates to that alchemical image of the peacock, that when you see the projection and you go through those stages and then before it goes back into the self, in the alchemy, then the peacock appears. So you see the path, but then that energy goes back down into the unconscious and then is used for your journey towards that goal. I wonder about that. Remember,
yeah.
We had that a couple of times.
The withdrawal of a projection, if it's a big deal, is a death.
Oh, okay.
You thought your partner was great, now you figure... Oh my God, I've married an asshole. Or the other way around. I married this poor person to help them, and I realize I'm the one that needs help, whatever version it is. And the more radical the juxtaposition of reality and projection, the more suffering is involved with withdrawing the projection. And then when that content is ready to be found inside, that's when you'll have the sunrise dreams or the peacock showing its feathers, the cauda pavona. Some of you might know that term. We've done in other classes. That's when you'll see the peacock.
Okay. And then that energy goes back, is taken back into the self.
That's taken back into the self.
Okay.
Again, just to give a simple example, I admire a writer. I realize that I have to be a writer. I get depressed because of all the work that's involved. Then the difference between it being integrated back into the unconscious or integrated into the ego, if it's integrated into the ego, I say, what book do I want to write? If it's integrated into the unconscious, you say, what book wants to be written? And then you follow that that capacity you found in yourself as if it becomes your guide and you are the traveler.
But you may not have insight into what book that is that wants to be written. You just continue on the journey until it makes itself known.
Until it makes itself known, exactly. Or you might try starting to write and you get frustrated and you quit. And, I mean, usually there's a fair amount of agony involved in withdrawing these projections. You may waste a couple of years trying to write that stupid book. And then one day you'll have a dream about what it should be. And I'm not trying to say it'll be easy, but you'll have a sense of being directed.
And that would be when you're back in that, because the fifth stage turns back into the first stage, and you're back to where everything seems to be flowing with the world.
Right. Exactly. You're a puzzle.
Well, I thought popped in my head, and I'm excited when you throw up. The behavior that animals have where they mark their territory.
Yeah.
It seems like that's part of all of us. And it fits in the projection somehow. I don't know exactly.
Well, I do. I mean, I think I do. You know, it occurred to me, animals project. If you take an abused dog, it will react to you in fear. So it's seeing you as a mean person. So this projection must go back to the animal kingdom.
What brain science
is it?
Mm-hmm. With the blind sight, this is the function of the anatomy of the brain, the function of matter within us, so to speak.
That's very interesting. I love this stuff. Yeah.
So at least say the image of Argus, he's full of eyes. Would that be the myth that would have fallen to blind sight? That there are other ways of seeing, that there are eyes? I suppose they aren't even eyes.
There's sensory organs somewhere.
Yeah.
Some
other ways of apprehension.
There is some research going on that says that every cell in your body, not just like your eyes are your main organ of sight, but that in the dying process, that you have some awareness through your other cells.
And even once your eyes are closed and your brain has very little. Yeah, that sort of gets to Rupert Sheldrake's morphic field in a way. The idea that.
I don't know the reference, but.
Rupert Sheldrake talks about our matter having what he calls a morphic field and something that extends beyond outwards from matter, whatever, this is just his name for it.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he talks about it interacting with magnetic fields and other energies. And what's his last name?
Sheldrake.
Sheldrake. I don't agree with nearly everything he says, but that just reminded me of his idea.
But it's kind of the consciousness and matter.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it the thousand monkey idea? That
Huh?
Hundredth monkey.
10,000. Yeah.
I'll make as many monkeys as I want. Hundredth monkey. That if
Go ahead.
You know that story? Do you know?
Well, I'm thinking about it right now, and I'm not sure that I remember.
If I remember, they started in Japan. They had monkeys that learned how to wash potatoes.
Right.
And then in another part of the island or another island where there would have been no connection, monkeys at the same time started washing potatoes in the ocean.
And then when the newborns were, and then when the baby monkeys started out doing it straight away.
And the baby started doing it straight away.
Yeah. Well, then they couldn't divorce that from weren't actually learning from other ones. As far as the babies were.
Yeah, probably. Yeah, you're right. Probably not.
So like if they were.
Or maybe they separated and they still did it.
Yeah. It was this idea that some critical mass got free.
Right.
And then it extended beyond the kind of monkeys that were contiguous with each other.
Mm-hmm. Now, I think this is so important. This is one of my, you've probably heard me bitch about it, one of my pet peeves about the 20th century, is postmodernism that says we can't know a thing. All we have is our own point of view. Mm-hmm. And this completely contradicts that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know with my dog, you know, he cannot be asleep and I will move and not make a sound and he knows it. And he wakes up. So he's experiencing something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I have a psychologist who keeps his dog in his practice. And he said the dog sits in the corner all the time, but as soon as somebody walks in suffering, the dog will go right to them. Oh, so the dog knows immediately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you experience that with animals.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is not just idle chatter, because what she wants to do in the later part of the book is ask, what's the nature of our unconscious? Another way of putting that is, what's the nature of our deepest processes that teach us knowledge? And so she's opening up the question, what is knowledge, basically, as we go along? Because we in the projected state, you do confuse your knowing with the object that is known. And, you know, whole lives are destroyed over this. Marriages are destroyed over this. But there does get to be a point where you can get some clarity on the nature of the perception, and then what has been projected becomes a source of orientation within you, and that's what she then will start focusing on. But it'll be a bit till we get there.
And you can see how that once served mankind very well to see the experience of the other as their own experience.
Because it created
a cave.
It bonded communities.
Yeah.
I think it's probably why these so-called primal societies are so tightly knit in traditional values, because it is the unconscious linking people.
Do you think that's still not in effect now, though? Are you thinking that in the past?
I think it is.
I think so, too, yeah. I
wasn't
sure what you were saying.
Yeah. See, I think it still has a place. Oh, yeah. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. I think it's still important. Mm-hmm. But how we are seeing the destructive side of it,
right,
as well as the positive side.
Right.
So now we have to contend with both.
Right.
And that's the change in the God image, from God being all good to God now being both good and evil, and you have to dialogue and make sure that you are taking a stand.
Mm-hmm.
Are you familiar with the Consciousness Project?
Mm.
What university is it? Anyway, they have a series of random number generators situated throughout the world, and they watch them to see if there are anomalies that occur in the random numbers that are generated.
So there are patterns within the...
There are patterns within number.
Yeah.
Okay, keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Pardon me? What was the last one? You said there are patterns within...
Number.
So I'm thinking of Jung's emphasis on number mm-hmm. as the essence of order.
Mm-hmm.
And before 9/11, before it happened, the random number generators started registering a huge anomaly.
Ha.
Wow.
Freaky.
Uh-huh. And then when the planes hit, it like was already way up before the event happened.
Wow.
And in big calamities that affect the whole world, they find, or also locally,
from wherever this random number generator is, they find that they show the future.
Interesting.
You know, the information is indeed leaking backwards. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Well, keep all of this in mind, because we'll be returning to these issues as we move along, for sure. Okay, so I think you got the basic idea. Two definitions, the stages of withdrawal. We'll build on all this stuff, but just so you got the basics, yeah.
But since we're talking about consciousness, though, I mean, what is, you would say, you know, consciousness is what you're aware of, because you can perceive things that you're not aware of?
No, that's a tough question. Jung distinguishes between consciousness and awareness. This is how I've tried to understand it, anyway. And I ask myself, so what's the difference? Here's the difference, I think. Consciousness notices contradictions and outcomes. I was talking to a guy whose wife's quite a mess. And she said, don't make a big deal on my birthday. I don't like birthday celebrations. So he bought her a modest present, cooked her a modest meal. And she was pissed because he didn't make a big deal out of her birthday. See, that's unconsciousness. It doesn't see contradictions. Now, that woman was aware that she said, don't make a big deal on my birthday. She was aware that she was angry he didn't make a big deal of her birthday, but she wasn't conscious. And the other one for consciousness is not seeing outcomes. I mean, have you ever heard anyone tell a story and describe the result and you say, what did you expect? That's a lack of consciousness. I was talking to somebody who was an artist who did, nobody we know here, who made some rather risque nude paintings and submitted them to a art contest in a conservative town and was rejected and was rather insulted by the way she was rejected. I have to say, what'd you expect? See what I mean? That is a lack of consciousness. And of course, that was proof that the world is full of Philistines who don't understand artists. So consciousness is consciousness is what notices projections. But I just tried to simplify it by saying it doesn't notice contradictions, it doesn't anticipate outcomes. Page 20, just a very brief point. A typical way that projections are symbolized in dreams is as projectiles. Bullets, arrows, stones. If you have a dream of shooting a gun, you might ask yourself, am I projecting? Throwing a projectile into somebody else. Not always, but it can be. Page 25 to 28, we got into this problem, which is really unsolvable in the final account. If you dream of somebody, how do you know whether you're dreaming of them or you're dreaming of the part of yourself that they symbolize?
Or both.
And the answer is, I don't know. trial and error. Sometimes one gets a feeling. If you've got somebody you're talking to who's a rageaholic and they're complaining about their boss being angry, you might think it's a projection. But it's not always so clear. And sometimes the person can be a rageaholic and the boss is angry, is an angry person. So it requires a great deal of tact.
And is part of that when you project on each other? I mean, when she projects on her boss and her boss could project on her.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Right.
So
so you're a rageaholic and you don't see it, so you're collecting rage.
Not to mention. If you've ever, you know, I have some friends who are just about splitting up after many years together, and when I hear them complain about each other, what they're describing is exactly who that person is and who they are too. They're both the same way.
But they can only see it
in the other person. Both will say, oh, they're so aggressive.
Well,
so are you, but you don't see it. Yeah. So, just to be aware that we are aware, or we are conscious of this problem of solving some of these issues. How it feels to be the object of a projection is discussed on page 30. You can feel it as a loss of soul. In other words, depressed, bored, lonely, at sea. Or you can feel it as if something is trying to take over your life.
You say this as if you're the subject of...
Yeah.
Is that
what
you said? Yeah. Or the object.
Sorry, I meant the object.
The object.
I meant the object. Though I think loss of soul... could also be if you're the projector. But usually when you're projecting, you're in, as Mary Woodman calls it, happy carrot land.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've been the recipient of a projection, you'll either feel taken over and odd, or you'll feel listless. Oh, so that was the first chapter. Then we moved on to the withdrawal of projections in religious hermeneutics. Hermeneutics just means interpretation. I thought it got really kind of tedious for a while. And she goes through how this process of withdrawing projections has evolved over the course of history. The Greeks originally would think, oh, there's a storm, that was the storm god. Then they began thinking, oh, the storm god is in the storm. So a slight differentiation starts to take place. I don't think that's all that important, other than to realize, I mean, I don't think the specifics in this chapter are that important, other than to realize how this process has been operating throughout history. And where you see it the most clearly is in the views people have held about the nature of gods or God. On page 38, she mentions that slowly the Greeks began to realize what they thought were gods were inner qualities. Now, that's not too offensive. But what does it mean if we start applying that little schema to our own understanding of God? That's where it gets dicey. So, to sort of build a bridge, she mentions several religious figures throughout history who slowly reinterpreted the Christian story, the Christian events, as they're reported, as metaphor. So that they weren't thought, Christ wasn't a literal Jesus, but Christ would symbolize some aspect of human experience. Still divine, but no longer simply historical. She talked about Origen's interpretation of Gideon's fleece about grace. She talked about this fellow, Joachim, I think it is, of Flora, page 50, who said that the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit were phases of history. So that God the Father lived in one phase of history, God the Son lived in another phase of history, and so on. They still took that metaphysical reality as primary, but they no longer tied it to the historical events.
What phase did the Holy Ghost period start? Or is that the modern
phase? That's the modern phase, yeah. The Joachim, I guess it is.
Joachim?
I think it's Joachim. I'm not sure. A Flora, Italian guy, said that history has got three periods. The age of the Father, which would be that period where people thought law was sacred. You have to always obey the law. And the age of the Son would be when love became more important than law. So basically he's saying, you know, that the Hebrew period of history, the Christian period of history. But the third is interesting, it's the Holy Spirit, so that what is considered sacred is continued inspiration. So love is still tied to the story, but inspiration allows the story to change. By the story, I mean the Christian myth. It's actually, Jung makes a lot of that as an interesting way of understanding where we are now, which is the transition from the age of the Son to the age of the Spirit.
It's really interesting because I know some evangelical people would say that, you know, it all stopped with Christ, like there's been no revelation since then.
Yeah. Really, I don't know, when did he live? Let's see, it's on page 50. Does she give a date? 1200. That's pretty amazing for 1200. Mm-hmm. He died in 1202. And so with the age of the Spirit, the myth continues to evolve. So that would be the transformation of the God image. And then, we stopped at page 50. But keep in mind, she's heading towards another big question. Okay. So what's the big point here? The big point is, what does it mean if we withdraw our projections from God? Try saying that in the theological context. You see how Jung is pushing the boundary of what is theologically acceptable. So if we look at the Greeks and say, well, Zeus symbolizes our power drive. Aphrodite symbolizes our erotic drives. Saturn symbolizes our depressive nature. What does God symbolize? Is the question she's coming to. And to move, let me say it another way. The traditional theological thinking would say, well, you're psychologizing God. Does that make sense? Jung would say, well, if we can say to the Greeks, Zeus is your power drive, why can't we say to the Christians, Yahweh is your, well, we don't know what exactly, but that it's time to begin saying that, asking that, not to reduce God to nothing but a psychological projection, but to clear the way for a new revelation. So if we can do that to other historical periods, why can't we do that to our historical period?
So the question is, what is the meaning of the Christian God that needs to be integrated?
Exactly.
And this is really just a God image, not
right.
Because we can never really know
exactly.
What that
yeah, right.
Is. So it's how we see,
right.
And that's the projection.
Exactly, okay. Exactly.
So which comes first then? Do you see the projection, see what God is projecting, so you can see the new image? Or do you see the image and then see that you're...
I think he'd say the former, that we're not going to get a new revelation until we have integrated the old revelation. And the way a new revelation prepares for its arrival, so to speak, is to induce doubt about the previous revelation.
And this is why the individuation process is so important, because this is like the microcosm of what's going to go on.
Right. Okay. Exactly. What we're forced to do, those of us who can't stomach the church, is go through personally what the society might be going through in the future. Let go of the specific form of the revelation, but find the equivalence in ourselves and stay attuned. Now comes this bit we've talked about, the non-ego character of what we've integrated.
If one's experience of God is Job-like and negative, you've got to pull that back in too, because
right.
That isn't the fullness either of God.
No, it's very important.
So there's that the goodness and the evil in Yahweh, and there's goodness in the
middle
and
mass
as well.
Exactly.
Well, that's part of the revelation.
It's part of the previous revelation we haven't caught up with yet.
Right.
Yeah.
Jews have. Christians have. At least in Jewish revelation.
Yeah. I would just say that could be part of the meaning of the Holocaust.
Could you say that the Job-like experience is the breakdown of the God image? I mean, what happened to Job was he saw God as he had a bargain with the universe.
Yeah.
If I behave in this way, good things will come to me.
Yeah.
And that all broke down.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And then on the... That was on a micro level, and then on the macro level, it was the idea, myth, or whatever, of Jesus died, and then in 3 days rose again, so he went from their spiritual leader who was divine to, wow, this is a much bigger divinity, he can even talk or die.
So if I got you right, you're saying that you could see the death and resurrection of Christ as a metaphor for the transformation of the God image. Yeah. Jung doesn't get into that so much, but I think he would certainly agree with it. And so the one of the things that's initiating this process is the inability to recognize evil. And it's all over the place. I was just reading a book by this guy, Galt, part of it anyway, The Death of the American Empire. You've seen that? It's interesting. And some of the things he says, I think, are really important. And, of course, he's just berating us for our invasion and our invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, which I totally agree with. But he says, where I don't agree with, he says, now, if we had just left our hands off of them, they could have had a peaceful revolution and got rid of the dictatorship. That was written before the Arab Spring. See the naivete. As if human beings, just after centuries of oppression, say, now let's talk about this. Let's talk about the fact you killed my mother and father.
And 40,000 other people.
So you see, that's the aspect of the God image which is still not even close to consciousness in the collective view of things. So as, you know, we've talked about this before, and just to sum up, I feel Jung is being profoundly in service of religion. It's just we've got to figure out what religion is. That's the problem. So, okay, let's look at then page 50. Now, she's going through the steps of what we would call the withdrawal of projections within Christian theology itself. And she looks at several ways that Christians themselves have begun approaching the kind of understanding that she's driving at. So I'll read for you. The last paragraph there on 50, second line. Certain rationalistic elements are unmistakable, standing in opposition to an overly concrete understanding of the Christian myth. Elements that today are for the most part looked upon as precursors of the Reformation. In other words, Luther attacked the primacy of the Mass. She sees that as a step in the withdrawal of projections, very beginning step. Second, there emerge attempts to expand the Christian myth with the help of the inspiration of the Holy Spirit without dismissing him in a rationalistic spirit. That would be like Joachim of Flora. That the Christian story is an ongoing paradigm of understanding. And third, there are clear indications of a tendency to deal by means of symbolic interpretation with what is no longer concretely believable and to understand it as a purely inner psychic happening in the experiencing subject. I think that would be Jung. Now, she sort of backtracks a little bit to the rationalizing of the Christian story. During the course of the succeeding centuries, the rationalistic tendency, fourth stage, became more and more the dominant one. And she refers to the Reformation. I don't know if you ever walked into any of these Zwingli churches in Zurich. There is not one image anywhere in those churches. They are concrete walls. Then she talks now culturally that the French Revolution, the American Revolution, are examples of that rationalistic tendency. Where we end with life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Where is God? Communism, another one, which devalues completely, from the point of view of reason, any religious life. Likewise, Freud. And I don't know if you've studied or come across this guy, Rudolf Bultmann, in Christian theology. He is, I don't know if he's still in vogue. He was when I was in divinity school. His thing is, you have to dismiss from the Bible anything that is logically impossible. So Christ could never have turned a few fish into many fish. He's saying the story is true. There was a Jesus Christ, but the way the story has been passed down to us is by mythologizing things, and when we see that mythological thinking, we have to dismiss it. So he's trying to make religion reasonable. And one of my teachers took the Bible and cut out every passage that he said was unreasonable. There wasn't anything left. So, you could say that she's critiquing both the view that says Jesus lived historically, therefore I believe, and she's criticizing the view that says I don't believe anything that is illogical. A projection has been withdrawn in the Bultmann theology, but no fifth stage occurs in which he says, so what are these elements, these irrational or non-rational elements inside us to which we have to establish a relationship? So both the literal and the rational tend in theology lead to the same outcome, which is no relationship to the inner process that these images represent. I think that's the real point of this chapter. If you're going to deconstruct religion, you've got to reconstruct it inside. Let's take a break, and we'll pick up that fourth to fifth stage shift in page 52 and return to her big question. Light Saturday.
I feel sorry for the ones that are missing it. I hope they'll listen to the tape and can get it.